This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, your weekly opportunity to listen in as my guest authors go deeper into the backstory of their literary work, with a specific focus on how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader at a time. And now, let me welcome this show's guest author, Anjali Mitter-Duva. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be on this.
I'm thrilled to have you. I am really so grateful for you to take some time away from your busy schedule. So, Anjali, you wrote Faint Promise of Rain. It is a novel, and it's the first of a four-novel series. Could you go ahead and tell my listeners a little bit about your story?
Absolutely. This is the first book in a set of four, and it is historical fiction, as they all will be. And this one is set in 16th century India, northwest India. It's the story of a little girl who was born into a family of devotional Hindu temple dancers, just as a new Muslim emperor is taking the throne.
What I really like about this story is that it's not four books all set in the 16th century, but you are literally going to span almost 500 years of real-world history with this series.
Exactly. So when I set about writing this book, and I can get to sort of what brought me to it in a minute, but when I set about writing it, I knew immediately that it was going to be one of four, and that I was going to take readers from the 16th century all the way up into 1970s and potentially even up until today. And so there will be jumps. You know, the second book that I'm working on now takes place 300 years after the first one.
That brings up a question, actually. If each story is a different character, then what is the common thread that's going to hold the four novels together?
So the common thread is a type of dance, actually. This is a type of dance called Kathak, and it is a traditional classical form of dance from India. India has a lot of forms of dance, and the one that most people, I think, who have seen any Indian dance have seen is a style called Bharatanatyam, which is actually from the south. Kathak is from the north, and it's the only style of Indian classical dance which blends both Hindu and Muslim influences and aesthetics, which makes it, I think, stand out, and which makes its history incredibly interesting. And it is the history of this dance form throughout, you know, the last 500 years, and the way that it has really mirrored the history of India, in that every time there's been a major socio-political shift in India, it's been paralleled or mirrored in the dance form in terms of who is dancing and for whom, you know, who's the audience and what's the context and the dance form itself, you know, the actual dance. And so that is the common thread. I'm telling the story of a tradition, the story of an art form over 500 years, but with fictional characters, with characters where hopefully the readers are invested in you know, those characters' lives.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know with the first novel, which obviously I've read, I found not just the main character, but several of the other family members and even close friends to really be, like, you're really hoping the best for them and you're dreading something bad that might happen. So I would say the investment level was actually pretty high. But let me real quick, how do you spell Kathak?
Kathak is K-A-T-H-A-K.
Got it. So why is it that the northern region of India has a dance form that is seen as a blend between Indian and, well, Hindu and Muslim, whereas the southern part of the continent is not seen as having a Muslim influence? Did the Muslim empire not reach that far?
Correct. Oh. India, you know, the Muslim empire, which became known as the Mughal empire, stretched down, you know, it came down from Persia and down from the north, and it did not make it all the way south. I don't know, I'd have to look at a map to be reminded of exactly where the line ended, but the region in which this dance form, Kathak, was most prevalent, did, well, it did and it did not. Parts of the region fell under the Mughal Empire. Mm-hmm. Ironically, although my characters in my book really fear that their part of India, the northwest desert state of what's called now Rajasthan, mm-hmm. although they fear that they would fall under the Mughal Empire, that part of India itself did not. It's in the desert. It's a strikingly beautiful area. But if you look at it from a tactical, you know, military mm-hmm. standpoint, it's very hard to mm-hmm. survive.
Right.
And the cities were all these fortress cities, and the warriors native to that region, to Rajasthan, the Rajput warriors were mm-hmm. legendary mm-hmm. for their fierce warrior skills.
If I remember correctly, I believe they would be the same ones that unfortunately were finally felled by the British. It was like a shock to the Indian nation.
Yeah, it was a shock that anybody could really overpower Rajasthanis. The British overpowered all of India.
Right.
Look at it that way.
Right. And that was mostly because of firepower?
Well, it was firepower, and it was also the British had a long view of things, and they bided their time. They came originally for commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was actually the intent. The intent was not to take over the administration of the country.
But they did sort of play different groups against each other and got actually, like, almost had India in a way crumble within itself.
Exactly. Yeah. It was kind of insidious. And little by little, as the British were in India, they started feeling a moral responsibility, as they put it. As a lot of colonizers have felt. Well, if you look at the history of India, the number of other rulers who have tried to include the Indian subcontinent in their in their territory is multiple. But yes, the Mughal Empire was a product of an earlier empire, which goes back to Kublai Khan. It mm-hmm. goes back to Timur the Lame, he's called sometimes, and Genghis Khan. I mean, it all started out in the same part of the world and expanded outward.
Okay, so the best thing about history, I think, is not just that it's fascinating, such amazing stories, and you have a really rich one in this book, but also that what we learn when we look back on how humans behaved then, it's like a playbook for today.
Right,
seriously. So there are some women's issues that come up in this story that why don't we dive into those a little bit, and then we'll get back to the dance and the diaspora
absolutely.
And all that. So women's issues. On paper, the mm-hmm. way women were supposed to be viewed, the way women were sort of put up on a pedestal, as happens in a lot of societies, but then the reality of how they're being actually treated.
Right.
Why don't you talk a little bit about that dichotomy?
This question's coming up a lot, and people are asking me. I mean, I'm of Indian heritage. I'm half Indian, and I've spent a lot of time in India. I've traveled there. And because of the spate of, you know, violent acts against women that have been taking place in India that have been, very much in the news and brought to the attention of the West, not that they didn't happen at other times, but the number of ways that news travels now and so quickly, it makes certain things able to come out in the open mm-hmm. much faster and to be discussed a lot. And so people are asking me, you know, what do I feel about it? And am I scared to go to India by myself? And it's a very complex and layered question. Women in India have had to deal with this. There's a dichotomy. There's a dichotomy in how they're viewed. And this has been the case for centuries. And so if you look, on the one hand, the mother, you know, capital mm-hmm. M, is a person to revere, is, you know, the notion of the mother as giving birth, as the creator, Mother Earth. I mean, it's all very reverential.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, on the other hand, you go in a bus in a crowded city in India, and, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're going to be groped by some guy who has a mother, of course.
Wait, are you serious?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I did not realize that. So, like, that much you would expect basically casual groping.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, but that's not the case just in India. If you get on a crowded bus in Rome, or mm-hmm. it happens as well. But for me, the thing is, to me, I think, well, what's hard to reconcile is, on the one hand, take an average Indian man, like a shopkeeper or someone, and you think, on the one hand, all right, he cares for his mother, and he reveres her, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, he does this to other women who might be somebody else's mother or somebody else's sister. Mm-hmm. And these two attitudes coexist, and they've coexisted for centuries in mm-hmm. India. I mean, forever, I think.
Well, and not only considered, but legally, many times that was the actual case.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not qualified to sort of talk about the law or, mm-hmm. or nowadays, supposedly women are equal, but even in the U.S., that's not so much the case sometimes. So,
right.
So people ask me, am I afraid to go to India by myself? And I mean, yes and no, it's still my country. Mm-hmm. I still am going to go. I mean, I'll take the precautions that I take when I travel anywhere by myself. But it is something I struggle with, you know, how women are viewed. And what really bothers me nowadays is that this is the picture of India that people are getting.
Mm.
And you know, I think I don't want people to think of what is one of my countries like this.
Mm-hmm.
Writing this book that, you know, is set in a historic time in which women were at the center of this beautiful art form, and they were, the dichotomy is there as well. So the women in my book are called Devadasis, which means they're mm-hmm. servants of God. They're technically, even more than technically, in a ceremony, they are wedded to mm-hmm. a deity.
Right. And the girl is told that from this point forward, she can never give herself in, you know, marriage to a man because she is already wed to the
correct.
The God.
So she is wed right. to Lord Krishna, and, mm-hmm. you know, this is a temple dedicated to Krishna, so he's the deity of the temple. So there, the temple had a number of girls who were there and served the temple as dancers, and they brought to life the stories of the Hindu gods and goddesses, and mm-hmm. they performed, they danced at major religious festivals, but also they danced at events, you know, in the court for a birth or a death or a marriage. They were considered auspicious. It was considered
right.
very good luck.
So temple dancers, I mean, I happen to love history, so I've looked at a lot of it. In general, across the board, around the world, well, at least in the old world, I don't know so much in the new world, although it's likely, temple dancers were not allowed to simply be wed to their god and to do dance. They almost always have actual patrons. And remember, you and I chatted a bit about, is it Memoir of a Geisha?
Memoirs of a Geisha.
Right, Memoirs of a Geisha, where there's a double standard for the women. So they've got mm-hmm. this one standard and then another standard. And they would have patrons.
Yes.
And so this girl, when she, right there at the wedding, if I understand correctly from the book, right there at that moment of being promised to her god, there are these wealthy men who are almost bidding amongst themselves to decide who's going to be her patron. And at a certain age, when she comes into her womanhood, then she goes and there's this relationship where she spends some time with him, but also the temple or on her own, she also would be sexually available to other people.
Right. Well, there were definitely very, you know, defined roles, certainly back then. These women were, they didn't have much choice. So, but the interesting thing is, you look around the world, any situation in which women are restricted in what they can do and
yep.
sort of, and even physically put in one place together, you look
mm-hmm.
at harems, or you look at, in my later book, I talk about courtesans who live in a courtesan house. Within that world, mm-hmm. they have certain freedoms. They have very strong friendship. They control that world. It becomes a very matrilineal system where it's the daughters who are the ones who inherit property they have or any mm-hmm. learnings, you know, teachings that are passed down to daughters. So it's interesting to think about what they've managed to develop within the constraints that are put
mm-hmm.
on them. And in the case of Kathak dance, what I think was fascinating in the shift from of what happened between the beginning of the Mughal era, when the dance was still a temple dance, to, you know, during the Mughal era, when it was brought into the Mughal courts and became a form of entertainment. By the time you get to the end of the Mughal era, in the 1850s, the women who have upheld this tradition, the women who are the dancers, a number of them have become quite powerful.
Mm-hmm.
They've come to a point where they can choose their patrons.
Mm-hmm.
They've come to a point where they own property. In some cases, the patrons have given them land, orchards, buildings. And if you look at the characters of my book that I'm working on now, the second one in the set, they have so much control, in a sense, that, for example, in a world in which all women were required to cover their heads, mm-hmm. And to be in what's called purda, they did not have to, and yet they chose to. These courtesans chose to, because when they went out in the street, they didn't want to give anybody an unmerited opportunity to see them,
mm-hmm.
because it was considered, you know, good luck to see a courtesan like that, mm-hmm. and they didn't want men to be able to go back to their friends and say, hey, you know, I got to see so-and-so. And mm-hmm. so they actually would cover their heads, but it was by choice. And by that time in history, these courtesans often had the ear of the nawabs or the governors or the nobles. They ended up advising, you know, providing a lot of political advice. They were very savvy. They were very
right.
savvy, and in a sense, they were even manipulative. They would manipulate their patrons into giving them more money. Or
we see that sort of across the board, that within the 1%. As it were, there will always be women who are able to influence. In fact, like in the Marco Polo series people are watching right now, they show Kublai is turning to his preferred wife, who happens to be the mother of his heir, and she's very influential, which, mm-hmm. I mean, it's unfortunate that it's such an incredibly small number of women in a society that would actually have that sort of power.
It's true.
Well,
it's true. Very
you know,
small.
The vast majority don't. And one of the things, like, it's interesting that for me, the horrendous rapes which have been reported mm-hmm. recently in India, just a few specific ones that have really sort of shocked the nation, which I see as a beautiful thing. The fact that India, the people of India, are horrified and angered by these acts. And it's not a mother who's being abused, but it's a woman who's out on the town with a friend, you know, and instead mm-hmm. of her being painted as, you know, deserving what happened or being whatever, the whole society seems to be in an uproar. I see that as a really great example that India is going through an ongoing shift, like all societies are, and it seems to be shifting respect. That's beautiful. What's sad, though, is the other story we really don't hear very much about, which is you go to downtown Seattle and there's a coffee shop on every corner. And I watched a documentary where they suggested that in many of the big cities in India, there is a ultrasound opportunity on every corner. And the number of families that are choosing to do what China's doing as well, which is to abort female
children.
I have found it very, very fascinating what is going on in China and India and other places probably, but those two countries in particular seem to have just a really, really, really high rate of, I don't even know to call it infanticide, it's sort of wrong. It's just major preference towards male children. And even a woman who is a doctor, well-educated, you know, and became pregnant with twin girls,
mm-hmm.
had to, like, I believe, either leave her home. She had to do something extreme in order to survive because her husband was so adamant that they couldn't afford the resources to raise two female children.
Yeah, the situation in India regarding female children, a lot of it comes down to the tradition, which thankfully is dying out now,
mm-hmm.
Especially in urban areas, but little by little in the countryside, of the dowry,
mm-hmm.
right? The idea that when you marry off your daughter, first of all, you're losing a potential person to care for you, and you're older, and you're basically giving your child to another family, and you are supposed to also pay the groom's family a substantial amount
mm-hmm.
to take, you know, for the burden of taking your
right.
your child.
Which is so weird. I mean, I think of it as a gift, but
right. Well, it's a very different for us. It's difficult right. for us to envision it like that. But it was an economic situation, you know,
right.
sort of an economic imperative. And as long as you abide by those traditions, then
right.
you find yourself stuck. And I'm sure it's a terrible. Obviously, it's a terrible choice to have to make.
So was it beneficial to, please remind me, because the spelling, I think I'm saying it wrong. How do you pronounce the name of the main character, the young girl the story is about?
Adira.
Okay, Adira. Got it. Was it a benefit for her family when she was, in a way, married to the church because they did not have to offer a dowry? or did they do that purely because of her love? Because she clearly loved dance, and the father loved dance because he was her father is the instructor, the temple.
Right, he's the dance master at
dance
the temple.
Dance master, right?
Well, he was. I mean, he was completely committed to this tradition.
Mm-hmm.
His father had been a dancer, and this was all that he, the Gandhar, Adira's father, mm-hmm. knew. And he had promised his father, he had promised himself, he had probably promised Krishna mm-hmm. that he would continue this tradition and that his children would all follow in his footsteps and would dance. Unfortunately, as you know from reading the book, what happens is that his first few children, mm-hmm. for one reason or another, a different reason for each one, turn their backs on dance.
Mm-hmm.
And his older daughter, who was trained as a dancer, runs away.
Right.
And we find out later what actually happened to her.
Right.
His son wants to be a warrior. And his son is motivated also by a love for the family and a love for the tradition and a desire mm-hmm. to do something about saving it in the face of the potential attack by the Mughal armies.
And yet he seems to object to his younger sister's wedding, marriage to the church.
The temple.
I mm-hmm. couldn't understand why he would object, because within that realm, within that world, marriage, which was basically largely familial servitude and the love of your children,
right.
you know, compared to the life of a temple dancer, it didn't seem to me like it was so horrific to be a temple dancer.
Well, it was, in a sense, because of, first of all, as you mentioned, the patrons and she basically had to you know, go and sleep with her patron whenever he wanted, and he was an
right.
old guy. And so obviously her older brother didn't want her to have to do that. But mostly for him, he was afraid that the entire temple and everybody would just get destroyed and killed if...
An intolerant empire
if the armies actually, if the mm-hmm. Mughal army actually took over. He was trying to protect his family in a very, you know, very essential way, and he
right.
was afraid that his father just had his head in the sand and mm-hmm. and was not realizing that something terrible was about to happen, and he didn't want his sister to be trapped in that
right.
in that system.
Right. So it's interesting, we look back 500 years, a little bit over 500 years mm-hmm. ago, and we see these human situations. You know, I love to call them human situations because horses just really don't get into this. You know, I mean, monkeys, yeah, sometimes they do, but you don't really see bluefin tuna, okay,
right.
dealing with the issues that humans are dealing with. So these are just human situations. We have an interesting species. And now we look today, or you could look 150 years ago.
Oh, you'll see the same dynamics.
Same dynamics, right.
You'll see the same dynamics of one parent who really wants something for a child and the other parent who may be feeling more ambivalent about it.
Right.
And the tension that causes within the marriage or the couple.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see one sibling wanting to follow his own path despite obvious signs that that's not going to work.
Right.
You'll find somebody who's just devoted to an idea, a tradition, an art, a something, and we'll put mm-hmm. that ahead of everything else. And you'll see people motivated by fear and motivated by
yeah.
love.
Yeah.
And then seeing the tragic consequences of that. That's timeless.
And then you can have in Syria, you can have the existing
right.
government in place can
mm-hmm.
be the fundamentalist attitude.
Right.
It's someone who believes I've got the one only acceptable answer or way of being, and I'm mm-hmm. going to murder, you know, anyone who disagrees with me or force them to pretend, at least on the outside. I'm in Spain, where the Moors and the Jews were living when Queen Isabella and her and Ferdinand,
mm-hmm.
the same ones that supported Christopher Columbus
mm-hmm.
crossing the Atlantic, they did horrific things with the cooperation of the Catholic Church in order to eliminate. And they eliminated Jews and Moors who had decided to pretend to drop their religion, give it up, you know, convert.
Right,
and they still
right.
got rid of them. Tell us a little bit about what happened with that transition in India.
Yeah. So what happened was, I mean, it's fear. There's a lot of fear of what might happen that motivates the characters in my book to act. And part of it is fear, you know, just general, just fear of change. And part of it is fear of what is going to happen to our tradition and to us, you know, physically. Are people going to come and harm us if our region here in Rajasthan comes under rule, you know, comes under Muslim rule? Well, these characters, some of them didn't live long enough to see that, in fact, what happened was that Akbar, who was the Mughal emperor who took the throne at the start of this book, who was only 13, by the way, at the time, but he, you know, somebody was acting on his behalf until he reached about 18 or so. Akbar ended up in the area of Rajasthan. What he ended up doing, realizing that he wasn't going to be able to conquer the region, you know, productively through fighting, he ended up forming alliances with a number of the what they were called princely states. And the way he did that was he would marry princesses and form an alliance with the prince or the king of that princely state, a commercial alliance. And, you know, then his you know, he had children who were basically, if you look at it, you know, part Hindu, part Muslim. He was very interested in the arts and very interested in supporting the arts. And this is how Kathak, this type of dance, ended up being brought into the Mughal courts and becoming sort of an institution in these courts and what had been a Hindu tradition. You know, the whole clash between, and I'm not a political scientist, so this is just, you know, what I've gleaned from my research. But the whole clash between Hindus and Muslims in the scope of history is a fairly recent one. And so certainly back then, people were not being forced to convert at all. But people could carry on their faith. And this dance form then, instead of losing itself, absorbed elements of the types of arts that were coming down from Persia with the Mughals. For example, Sufism, you know, the Sufi poetry and Sufi devotional.
The whirling dancers. Yes, so
the, you know, the whirling of the Sufi dervishes got brought into Kathak, and so now if you look at a Kathak performance, you know, now 500 years later, it is full of these dazzling spins. You know, it's quite breathtaking. Also, mathematics, you know, Persian, the influence of certain patterns and mathematical constructs, that really got brought into the dance, so that now it's very linked to mathematics, actually, which is in the history of this dance form a newer, you know, something new. And you look even towards the end of the Mughal era, the book that I'm writing now, it's set in the city of Lucknow. Only 10% of the population was actually Muslim, even though it was, you know, ruled by Muslims. Only 10% of the population was Muslim, mostly Sunni, although the court itself was Shia. And that was okay. You know, that itself was not an issue. There were Muslim and Hindu soldiers, or they were called sepoys, infantrymen, who served for the British Army, you know, side by side. And it was only after that, you know.
Wait, for the British Army?
It was a British Army, but the British very quickly realized that you could buy loyalty.
And they continued to serve side by side once the British came in and occupied the country.
Yes, and they continued. And in fact, when there was an uprising, you know, uprisings against the British, a lot of them, one of the major uprisings, which ultimately sort of ended the Mughal era because the British quashed it, but one of the big uprisings, which takes place during the time that my second book is set, was by both Muslim and Hindu sepoys, they were called infantrymen, who were serving the British Army, but who revolted against the British officials.
And failed, unfortunately.
And failed. And unfortunately, it was very bloody. It was very messy. And it destroyed, you know, it destroyed lives and people and cities.
So during the Hindu period, before your story is set in, temple dancers, it was just the mainstream society in a way. And then the Muslim Empire came in and essentially said, commerce-wise, you know, we want to have influence. We want to be able to, you know, have better access to resources by having more control of what's going on. Probably they shipped some stuff, you know, back home to other areas.
Right.
You know, extended their their influence.
Uh-huh.
And then we have, ironically, the British come in a way they took advantage of sort of simmering disputes between different groups and were able to play this
exactly.
person against that person and mm-hmm. sort of collapse the entire continent of India within itself and take over for a period of time. And I believe this is very similar to what worked so well in China, where they came in and the British, I don't know if everyone knows this, but the British were the ones that stimulated and developed the opium trade in China.
Right.
They were the drug dealers
mm-hmm.
to China,
mm-hmm.
Very proud of it, very mm-hmm. happy of the money they were making, and more than happy to see it destroy also China mm-hmm. from within and the
right.
Opium addiction. Because opium, after all, I believe, does not come from China. It comes from Afghanistan and regions like
yeah.
that. So the British were really good at crumbling society
yeah.
and then stepping in, taking over.
And then stepping in saying, we're going to help and save you all. Right?
And when they did step into India, unlike the Muslim empire before them, they said, ooh, we don't really like how you're doing things because we're
exactly.
morally superior to you. So
yeah.
these women who were these fabulous Kathak dancers
mm-hmm.
lost their patrons and were driven into the red light district by the British.
Right. So ironically, the British created the situation they thought was already there in that they arrived and they concluded that courtesans were immoral. Now, part of it is because what was going on in England at the time and, you know, the Victorian values.
Right.
And so part of it was because of what was going on in England
mm-hmm.
and the imposition of Victorian values. And they were not appreciating, the British were not appreciating just how actually cultured these women were.
Mm-hmm.
They were also feeling threatened, the British were feeling threatened because there weren't that many British women at the time. Suez Canal opened up a little bit later. I think 1860-something, that allowed for a much quicker passage to India. And a lot more British women would come and join their husbands or came sometimes in search of a husband.
Mm-hmm.
But before then, there were a lot of men in the army, in the British army, who would go find, you know, female company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they often actually did go to red light districts and
right.
to prostitutes, and there was a lot of syphilis, mainly, you know, disease.
Syphilis, I'm really curious sort of what your history has pulled up about that. One of the things that I've read
mm-hmm.
is that syphilis may very well have actually been a disease of the New World that was brought home
yes.
by
yes.
Christopher
Columbus.
So
it's unclear where it started. And, you know, for the purposes of my research, I haven't really looked into the origin of it. I know that it existed. You know, who originally brought it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But by the 1850s, you know, a lot of British soldiers were, you know, sleeping with the same women.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was going around.
And coming home to their wives eventually.
Right, right, right. And so what the British failed to appreciate was that the courtesans were different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying there was no disease or anything among the courtesans, but they were not your, you know, quote unquote common prostitutes. But they just kind of swept it all into one category,
mm-hmm.
determined that these dancing girls were immoral, and they banned Kathak, they banned the dance.
Mm-hmm.
By then, unfortunately, they had taken over the rule of the area, and so all the noble, you know, wealthy patrons no longer had the means to support the courtesans, and because they had lost their property or lost their land.
And probably the courtesans, as they observed the shift in who had power, would have actively sought out relationships with the British.
They did not. They did not feel kindly disposed towards the British.
Got it.
At that point. And in the end, what happened is a lot of them resorted to the only thing that they could resort to
right.
support themselves and their daughters. And so they entered the red light districts.
Right.
But they had to dance clandestinely. They couldn't do it out in the open for a number of, you know, a number of decades.
I think this happened in Iran, where you had the
yeah,
women who were dancing. Yeah, they were. Maybe 10 years ago, there was a woman who was talking about how she had been one of the few remaining Persian dancers, and finally just the fundamentalists just made it too dangerous.
Right.
But probably that form of dance will also come back to the mainstream at some point when the society allows it.
So interestingly, the teacher of my teacher, his name is Pandit Chitresh Das, mm-hmm. who unfortunately, very unfortunately, passed away a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. He remembers, he was 70 when he passed away, and he remembers going to learn dance from his teacher in the red light district. Now, of course, when he was a nine-year-old boy going to take lessons, he didn't necessarily fully appreciate where he was going or what was going on around him. But he has some very definite poignant memories of going and basically being taught alongside the children of prostitutes. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, recently, in recent years, he's actually gone back to Calcutta, to the same red light district, to teach the children of prostitutes as a form of sort of empowerment and self-expression. You know, it's come full circle and become something different. It was very moving for him to come back to where he originally taught.
Right.
And to teach these girls, but for, you know, to help them get out of their situation.
Right. If he could develop their skill to a level where they would be paid better wages as a dance artist.
Well, not only that, but also just to give them self-confidence, to give them a way of expression, just to even alleviate their day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much it was going to help them really move out, but I think it was to give them some hope and a view into something different.
Mm-hmm.
And something to focus on and an art, something to believe in.
So let's touch in on that a bit. So we were talking about the diaspora of mm-hmm. artists from the Indian continent that spread in particular to the Western world and how it seemed to happen largely begin in the 60s and 70s. I had mentioned Bikram Yoga, for example, which I adore. Bikram also came to California around that same time as your Kathak instructor. What was it like? Basically, the children of the 60s and the 70s here in the United States were really looking for alternative ways of viewing the world and hope, because the standard American, Western, capitalistic, Protestant, you know, type of perspective had really, you know, left them needing more, needing something different. And so what were you saying about how the people of India found that they could come here and share their knowledge and that it was
right.
fertile ground?
Right. So there was a wave of artists and people in the performing arts, in the healing arts, who left India in the 1970s, late 60s or very early 70s, and found, you know, a new home in the West, often in the U.S. or in Canada, and within the U.S., sometimes in California, as did, you know, our school's guru, as we call him,
mm-hmm.
and in the true sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, then they faced an immense challenge, and the challenge was a challenge that anybody who's trying to uphold an ancient tradition encounters, is that here they were in a completely different cultural environment, and while people around them may have been very open to learning from them, they were coming at it from a completely different angle, a completely different culture. And so how do you maintain the integrity of a tradition that can be, you know, hundreds or thousands of years old, and yet still be flexible enough to adapt it to a different context, a different culture, and a different audience? And that's something that I think all artists who are bearing a tradition like that encounter.
Mm-hmm.
So here he was, this young man from Calcutta, you know, steeped in this ancient tradition, having learned in the red light district of Calcutta, coming to, you know, California, San Francisco area in 1970. And as he put it, you know, all his students were blondes and brunettes and hippies, and they would, mm-hmm. you know, put aside their joints and walk into the class. And here he was. It was a completely different slate, you know, to deal
right.
with.
Right.
And that is something that one struggles with, you know, even now. I teach this type of dance too, Kathak.
Mm-hmm.
This was when I started studying this dance form in 2001. Was really my introduction to this whole world. I hadn't realized just how much influence it would have on my life.
Mm-hmm.
But we're confronted all the time with the realities of modern life in juxtaposition to the art that we're teaching. We have students who come and ask, for example, can I videotape class? Or sometimes they won't even ask, they just start doing it. They whip out their iPhone and they start videotaping class.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand people are busy and they can't make it to class, you know, five times a week like people used to do, etc. But this is an oral tradition. This is something that's been passed down from teacher to student, to, you know, all the way down for generations, simply orally.
Right.
In by physical presence, and you come and you absorb and you learn, and then you pass it down. So we usually say no, mm-hmm. you can't videotape it. That's not how you learn this. And it's not everybody who's open to hearing that.
Right.
You know, they don't think like, oh, well, why not? I don't have time, or I want to be able to practice at home, or. And you know, as a person living in this world, of course, I understand to a great extent.
Right.
But you have to figure out, you know, where you can be flexible and where you have to take a stand.
Mm-hmm.
And our teacher.
I think we were talking a little bit about my experience with Bikram yoga, because mm-hmm. my first instructor is in a way old school. Very much harks to the way in which Bikram himself actually taught the form. And so she's, by American standards, could be viewed as challenges you, and fairly, not harsh is the wrong word, but she's not going to let you get away with anything, and she won't, she's not there to coddle you, which for me,
right.
having been a dancer for a very long time and always being someone who generally challenges myself to be the best I can, I thrive in that environment. I want to constantly know there's better that I can do. I don't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to a different studio. For example, you really don't drink water. It's an
right,
hour and a half
right.
long and
104
to
yeah.
5 degree. And you don't take a potty break. You don't drink water. You don't talk. There's a spiritual practice and a seriousness to it in a way that matters. And then I go to this other studio and they'll say, oh, well, that's okay if you can't do that. Or, okay, everyone take their water break. And all these people break out of their meditation, grab their bottles of water,
right,
start
right.
chugging water. And I'm still just standing there meditating, you know, on my forehead in the mirror in front of me, surrounded by the sounds of
guggling. Trying not to be distracted.
which is good. See, because that's a practice. My practice then is to not be distracted. So I can enhance my practice. Whereas my other teacher says, come on, it's an hour and a half of your day without drinking water. You're supposed to hydrate before you get here. You know,
right.
I mean, who can't
right.
go 90 minutes without taking a drink of water? If
right.
you have to drink water, you know, so it's completely different. And one is the very American, always have your water bottle everywhere you go,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's a coddling
right,
element.
Right, right.
And the other feels to me like more like an Eastern philosophy aesthetic
right.
sort of attitude of, I'm going to believe you're capable of your best, and I'm going to challenge you to get there. I mean,
exactly.
What do we expect Buddhist monks, you know, to be doing? Oh, it's okay if your back hurts. You don't have to meditate today.
Well, no. I mean, the people who achieve amazing things,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't achieve it by stopping for a water break every 2 minutes or,
right.
or, you know, stopping when something starts to be uncomfortable.
Right. And so you're bringing up such a great point about the interweaving of deeply different society.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, even now, Kathak used to be a Kathak solo performance, which is usually what they were. Kathak was always a solo art form. And it could go on for 3 hours easily.
Mm-hmm.
But audiences, certainly Western audiences, can't handle that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to sit for 3 hours and watch one artist, no matter how amazing that artist is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Kathak performances have adapted to that, and now there's also more choreography and there's more ensemble, you know, ensemble pieces, and,
mm-hmm.
and some of that is great.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it
sure.
is innovative and has brought about wonderful elements and added to the art form.
Right. We don't want to be overly attached
exactly,
to any
exactly.
one thing. I hope there are still sometimes opportunities for authentic Kathak performances. I would imagine.
There are. I mean, sadly, there's a generation of amazing classical Indian dancers and musicians who are, you know, in their 70s and 80s now, and some are starting to pass away.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is definitely a shift. However, what they've imparted to their students is, you know, 110% authentic.
Right.
And now it's their students' responsibility, challenge, burden, opportunity, however you want to look at it, to
mm-hmm.
take that and move it forward while still adding to it as opposed to detracting from it.
So what I find beautiful about this interview, and right now for those of you just joining us, you are listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I am speaking with Anjali Mitter-Duva, the author of Faint Promise of Rain, the first of a 4-novel set written by an Indian-American French novelist. And what I love about this is that this novel, these characters, the world that they're engaged with and the issues that they're facing and dealing with are prevalent in our society today. The beauty of reading a book like yours is that it enhances and alters and impacts your view of the life you're living right now. A historical novel does not need to be something that is set aside and foreign to our current world. And we've had this great interview talking about all these issues, from the dance form itself, Kathak, to women's issues, challenges of maintaining the integrity of tradition when culture changes, fundamentalist attitudes versus embracing attitudes of, you know, the Muslim emperor at the time in the 1500s. So all of these amazing conversation topics, they all will be found in a way in this novel. And so this is why I invited you to be a guest on my show, because that's the whole point of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, is that there is a real world impact in our own lives that will be felt when we read this story.
Well, thank you. It's been really a pleasure having this conversation and getting to talk about all these issues. And there will be similar ones and additional ones in the next books, and even ones which I hadn't anticipated, but I'm realizing as I write are coming up, which for me is the exciting part about writing this type of book.
Oh, yeah. And I'm really excited. So book 2 is going to come in right before or during the British occupation?
It's going to come in actually at the beginning of the actual British rule. I mean, the British had already been there. The British were there from the 1600s onwards in a commercial capacity. But the 1850s is really when they solidified their political, you know, role as governing the country.
Well, and if you're switching from commerce to governance, I would imagine during the commerce period, they probably had enough people with them that had military capabilities that could protect their caravans or whatever. But then there would be a shift to actually having, well, sort of like any country of today would do, where you go into a country and you bring your military to have a presence there because you actually want to back up your efforts at governmental control of the society.
Right, right. Although a lot of people in the British Army were actually Indian.
And they had allegiance to the British because their individual Raja had told them to go have allegiance?
No, because the British were paying them. It was that simple.
Oh.
The systems of payment from, in fact, in the state that the second book is set in, I don't have a title for it yet, which sort of is awkward. I always refer to it as my second book. But
book 2.
In that state, the governor, the Indian governor, known as the Nawab, was actually he was a big patron of the arts, and so he was spending a lot of his time paying attention to arts and writing poetry and not paying a whole lot of attention to what was going on in his in the province of Awadh, it was called.
Right.
And so his military was not getting paid on time. So along come the British with a very organized system and money to spare, and you know, they say, well, we'll hire you and you work in our army and you'll get X amount and you'll get it on time. Mm-hmm. And so there you go.
Right. Interesting. Ah, I'm looking forward to that. Anjali, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure.
And that's Faint Promise of Rain, which I happen to know you've got a really nice blog and also an actual webpage. So Anjali.
Yep.
Is spelled A-N-J-A-L-I, Mitter-Duva. And if you just put in the Duva, D-U-V-A, Anjali Duva, they can find everything they want to about you and your novel. And I look forward to, let's see, maybe in about, well, I know how long it takes to write a novel. Would you say in about 2 years or 18 months, hopefully I'll have you back?
I think probably about 2 years. I have a goal to finish a draft of this book by next January, but then I'll still need some revision, and then it'll have to get out to the market. So.
Right. Excellent. Thank you again, and have a great day.
Great. Thank you very much. Same to you.
And that's our show, folks. Once again, you are listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSH. This is March Twisdale, program host and producer of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, the show where authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader at a time. And now, before we go, I'd like to share with you one more of my Vashon After the Change flash fiction series. So, as many of you know, I am writing a series of flash fiction pieces based upon the concept of Vashon After the Change, this miraculous or frightening or magical, whatever you want to call it, moment where our island, set here in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, becomes suddenly cut off from the entire world. In the middle of the night, when everyone magically falls asleep at the same moment, which probably never happens in real life, but on that day it does, this mist sort of comes down over the ocean surrounding the island, and everything from the outside world just is cut off, and the island becomes completely isolated. This was created initially about 7 years ago when, as a homeschooling mother, I wanted to introduce my children and other children on the island to the concept of local resources and sustainability, as well as our dependence on external off-island resources. And I thought, how do I do this and have it not be a dry lecture? How do I do this in a way that will engage? And so I decided to go ahead and create this story, this little seed of a story, and then say to a group of children from the age of, let's say, 9 or 10 up until about 15, okay, here you go. Vashon is suddenly cut off magically at 4 o'clock in the morning. And from that point forward, people start to wake up. Life seems normal until it isn't. What happens next? And the idea was that the children would sit there for maybe an hour with me and would talk and discuss and brainstorm what might happen. Imagine for yourself what would happen at the beginning of that day. People might wake up in their homes and there's no electricity. So what do you think? Oh, a tree fell down, the power's out. But you still get in your car. Your car still runs. You still need to catch that ferry and go to work. So people start driving along, dun-dun-dun-dun, and they notice that the radio isn't working. Okay, well, that's weird. You know, that doesn't usually get associated with a power outage. Wonder what's wrong with my radio. Darn, I'll have to go see the mechanic. And they go get in line. But no ferry shows up. And the line starts to build up. What would happen? When would people, how would they act? Would they get out of their car and walk down to the ferry looking for a ferry worker to say, hey, you know, we've missed two ferries, what's going on? And when would people decide to give up on waiting in the ferry line? Where would people go? How would they communicate and respond and react in the hours, days, weeks, months following this magical moment? So this is Vashon After the Change, subtitle Winter Delivery. Most of these are written from the perspective of youth experiencing this change, and these are like daily journal entries. So imagine we're about almost a year and a half after that moment. Here we go. The pony shied as another gust shook the trees around us, the scent of cedar whipping through our hair. This is stupid. I imagine the cart flipped, the road littered with hundreds of cracked eggs. You want to skip it? My brother snapped. Nerves, not the chill January air, set his voice on edge. I dug gravel and manure out of Zigzag's hooves, avoiding the question. That's what I thought. He reached for the girth, cinching the harness with ease. It'll be far worse tomorrow. He eyed the encroaching storm warily. With the temperature dropping this fast, we're likely to get snow. Snow's better than rain. I checked the cart and gave the thick padding around the cartons a final tug before untying Zigzag's halter lead. You gonna get the gate? My brother's scarf snapped wildly behind him as he ran ahead. He'd be warm today. I felt jealous. He'd spend the next 2 hours running eggs while I'd be stuck in our wind tunnel of a road, navigating pony and cart through a year and a half of tree litter and abandoned vehicles. The sharp report of a tree limb cracking
rang out ominously as I checked that the lead was not wrapped around my hand, tightened my grip, and swung the loose end behind me, slapping the pony's butt. Walk on. Driveway after driveway, my brother ran up and down, shuttling eggs to the houses on the north side of the Fisher Loop Collaborative. 28 houses, with 2 to 3 families per, put demand, or hope, at nearly 150 dozen eggs a week. If it weren't for the solar panels on our roof and the lights in the chicken coops, we'd have no eggs in the dark of winter. Damn if that wouldn't be enough to drive some over the edge. Hey! Zigzag's head jerked hard as my brother bounded toward us, a stack of empty cartons tucked under one arm. Pressure's dropping, he called, forgetting that ponies spook easily, especially this one. Clambering into the cart, he slid the empties into a now vacant corner. The wind stopped, too. Soft white clouds puffed out of him like an old-fashioned choo-choo train. Snow for sure, then? I asked. He nodded, and that's when we heard it. A grinding, then growling, then screeching so loud I couldn't place it except to know it was near, so near. And then the world above us was churning and convulsing as a writhing green monster slammed down on us. We survived because of the pony. As the largest tree on Cove Road succumbed to age, time, the weather, or all three, Zigzag's prey instinct set in, sending him, the cart, my brother and me, hurtling forward down the wind-brushed road. Only while my brother gripped the cart's edge, his face whitened with fear, I was dragged along the ground, my hand having gotten wrapped up in the lead rope after all. This is an original work copyrighted by March Twisdale. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or transcriptions of this piece is expressly forbidden without the written permission of the author. And that's it. Once again, you've been listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSH. This is March Twisdale, program host and producer of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, the show where authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader at a time. And now, I'll close with a new song for 2015 titled Monster by Allison Shirk. One more example of activism through art.
Know. mystery.